probably talk in a bit more detail. Like we've been talking before that, you know, in the last couple of weeks, given the demands on us, none of us are being wildly inventive here. And I certainly am staying very close to a very simple set of offerings. When people ask for help, I don't go, you could use this, you could use that. We're saying, here's your Moodle shell. Here you go. Here are the bare basic instructions on how to get through this. And then we send them to resources, begging them to be kind to students. That's essentially what we're doing. So obviously we're going to have a challenge getting back to that, but yeah, I mean, at this same time, you know, I wonder, you know, what you think about something like the NGDLE model and what that means. And right now that feels very, very remote from what we're trying to deal with, not only now, but soon.
Yeah. And my objection to that model has always been the implicit maintenance cost of it. And I think that implicit maintenance cost makes it something only a few institutions can actually afford. And a lot of the writing and the thinking about the NGDLE has been about technology. It's been about technology integration. It's been about standards. It's been about, you know, how you plug these parts together and the way in which data might flow underneath that. But none of it has really tangled with any of the human factors. And there's two big parts that I think have never been properly considered. And one is the impact on students. But putting that aside, the maintenance costs of essentially what are many moving parts, because, yeah, you might be able to snap these things together, but they're not all changing on the same release cycle. Different companies will change their products at different, you know, at different speeds. Different open source products will change at different speeds. Okay, you've got a bit more control over that, but you're trying to manage many, many moving parts. And there's only a few institutions can afford that. And there's two parts to that. There's the kind of ed tech IT maintenance angle on that, but there's also the resilience of staff who are using these systems, you know, their kind of tolerance for change. So if you've got an institution that's got money falling out of its pockets and a really good embedded use of digital, yeah, it's a thing you can realize. But if you're a community college in wherever, no, it's so far off the realms of possibility, it's insane.
Especially if your IT department now is like trying to keep its VPN network up in a way that it never had to before, or suddenly having demands on its student information system being hammered by, you know, 300 remote workers now.
Yep.
And things like that. It's like, it's not like our existing resources are available necessarily.
No.
Like
it, and any kind of complexity in a crisis is just a massive risk.
It's a breakdown point. And it just doesn't seem resilient to me. It feels like a digital house of cards.
I think it is, yeah. And I mean, if you rely on a large workforce to keep it going in a time like now, when people are going to start getting sick, you know, it becomes a very fragile and brittle infrastructure very fast.
And I don't like to just introduce one more complication, but I mean, there's clearly going to be some sort of economic disruption in the next couple of years. I don't know what we're going to call that. So again,
global recession, maybe?
Already, I have thought that one of the biggest problems I've had with a lot of the kind of NGDLE type model or these, you know, really, really rich tool sets from lots of providers is that it's just not stable. I mean, vendors at the best of times change their terms of use. They change their business models. They change their architectures, or they go broke, or they get bought out. You can't tell me that this market is going to be more stable in the next 2 years than it's been in the last 2 years, and it's been a mess for the last 2 years.
Yep. Yeah. But I think that also underscores, I mean, the economic piece further underscores a lot of my dislike of this model, or dislike of this model when it's framed purely in terms of single institutions, because it's only affordable by the haves, not the have-nots. So it's not affordable now. Well, who are the people who are going to, you know, be comfortable? Well, probably not comfortable, but are going to ride out what's ahead better than others. You know, it's the ones with deep pockets again. there are any number of small institutions who are going to be looking for every saving they can possibly make. And again, any kind of complexity, anything that's, you know, not core and not critical to just keeping going is going to disappear. Mm-hmm. And we already have a two-tier kind of education system. In whatever country you're in, they're definitely post-secondary institutions fall into two buckets, whatever names you might use for them. So this is just going to exacerbate that, and it's just going to entrench that. But the conversation we had with Malcolm Brown when he was in Kamloops for ETUG, when we posed some of that question to him in the Virtually Connecting session, the space that we got to was actually one of the ways in which we can maybe do something different, maybe realize something different, is if we think about shared service models, if we think about pooling and sharing, rather than thinking about the NGDLE as a thing that every institution stands up itself. Because that's the fundamental problem, that every institution is operating individually and, to be honest, kind of in competition with each other. That's the neoliberal marketization of education. Mm-hmm. But actually, if we think about it from a collaborative kind of viewpoint, then there is a little bit more possibility of having a little bit more than just the LMS and video conferencing and some remote proctoring, because that risk is shared.
Yeah. And I not to be too literal minded, but I feel like that's kind of can bring us back to the Open ETC a little bit.
That might have been where I was going.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, please continue.
No. I was just lining it up for you.
I actually was almost going to pose it as a question. I mean, I think when we wrote the abstract for this conference proposal, I think we were framing it in terms of rolling this stuff out to our users, because that's where our focus has been, I think. We've been internally talking about things like governance and funding and things like that. But in terms of where our activity that people would see is, it's gone on things like the clone zone and testing things like CloudRon and trying to assess what we offer and how do we make our doc, you know, at least that's how I see it. I'm sure others might see it differently. But when I listen to you talk, I also realize, I think even though we didn't use these words very often, I think we were talking about shared risk coverage and resiliency too, I think. Like having that set of tools available to us means that if there's a round of IT cuts, you know, in one institution, hopefully that won't kill all of us, that we can be a bit more resilient as a result.
Yeah, and there's plenty of models out there for this. I've talked in the past about some of the work I've seen done in France, where there is a government-level mandate around open source in the public sector. And now, from doing collaborative development to take open source projects and make them fit the French education sector, they're now moving on, and I say they, there's a kind of very large consortium of French universities called ISIP Portail, which is about 80% of French HE and gets funded directly from the French Education Ministry. And they're now moving from groups of institutions collectively doing the work to take a product and or open source project and quite often internationalize it, actually, because we're a bit rubbish at considering any language apart from English. But doing that work to make it fit the French education system. But they're now moving into running shared services. So, you know, some of the larger institutions who have better infrastructure, better technical resources, perhaps some, you know, cloud-based computing capacity, are standing up services that can then be used by others in the sector on a subscription basis. So yeah, at that point, yes, you're buying a cloud-based product, but you're buying it from another part of the sector. So if you like, your money is just circulating within the education sector. So, you know, from a French government perspective, that's keeping money in France, it's keeping French people employed, and it's directly supporting the education sector as a whole, rather than kind of money just bleeding out to vendors. So, a lot of the challenge I see, and with the work I do for Aperio in the open source space, is this kind of assumption that open source is, bluntly, a dude in a beard and a server under a desk, right? You know, and you can run open source on AWS. You can stand up a shared open source service on AWS. Campus Press, that's, you know, open source software offered as a commercial product. What are you buying at that point? Well, you're buying some customization from them, but you're buying a service contract and you're buying some access to support that you know, you might not have in your institution. So I think what we're doing with the OpenATC is it falls into that sort of space. The bit that I think takes it further is where we say, well, it's not a service. You're not getting a support contract. You're not getting a service level agreement. Mm-hmm. It's not constructed that way. It's, you know, how can you, if you contribute, you'll get. Mm-hmm. And that's the bit where I think the challenge for us is we were slowly starting to push that model. Mm-hmm. And now I think that's going to be a bit of a harder sell.
I was just thinking that exact thing. I mean, I think both of us are thinking the exact same thoughts at this exact moment. And maybe I'm coming to that realization. I've been so head down. I haven't had a chance to really reflect very much lately. Because, yeah, that's been our biggest, I wouldn't call it a struggle. It's just been, we know we've been presenting a different model of working than a quote unquote shared service.
Mm.
And, or at least how it's understood here. And, that's always been the thing. You know, every time someone comes to us, we always seem to have the same conversations with them. No, we're not giving you a service. We're inviting you to come collaborate with us and share the responsibility with us and take on some pieces yourself. And that's what you give us to get what we give you. And that's been fun under some circumstances. I think where you were getting at, if I understood you, was that's going to be a lot harder conversation to have in the future, I think.
I think people are going to see it.
At least in this immediate term when people are flipping out.
Yeah, I think people are going to see it as risk because the bit that every institution is going to be doing after this is rewriting all their business continuity plans. Mm-hmm. Jeez, we need to get jobs in like disaster management and business continuity consultancy right now. If you want to make a killing in the next 6 months, that is the industry to work in.
Yeah, but I think one of the things being killed would be my will to live. I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm kind of in disaster management already.
Yeah, but, you know, consider the anarchy that we could wreak.
Again, I feel like I don't lack for anarchy.
Oh, I'd like love to get. I mean, everybody's going to be screaming out for that capacity and that service, yeah. Right? So, like, they'll already.
No, people are going to be looking for turnkey solutions because they're going to want to remove things from their set of responsibilities and offerings. They're going to want to either get rid of services or hand them off for sure.
Yeah, and it's back to the risk thing again. The idea that especially if you're a small institution, you don't have many people on the ground. In a situation like this, if those people get sick, then you've run out of people. And that's going to be that's the bit we're going to have to keep in mind and we're going to have to emphasize. It's the sharing bit of this. So we talk about collaboration. You know, to some extent, collaboration is a nice thing to do, right? But sharing is where the risk mitigation is. Sharing knowledge, sharing experience, and sharing, packaging up some of that in ways that are then very fast and quick and easy to use. So like things like the clone zone. So rather than everybody having to work out how to do a thing, I mean, that's an excellent example of a turnkey solution, if you want to think about it that way. Mm-hmm. So we're going to have to reorient the way in which we present what we do with the OpenATC. Before we started recording this, we talked about the pivot we're going to have to make after we're finished with this pivot is we've necessarily retreated back into a whole bunch of established technologies, and where new technologies have been introduced, things like video conferencing or remote proctoring, they're not necessarily always great solutions. Mm-hmm. And they've been a way to get people to engage, and they've been a way to get people online in a way that doesn't feel too distant from the way in which they currently teach. We know that good online pedagogy doesn't look like what we're currently doing.
But we know this isn't the time to have that conversation. Like, there's a certain clueless, high profile. Well, I don't know how high profile it is. Doesn't look like anyone I care about is paying attention to it. But, you know, I took a look at this supposed response to pivoting, and it seemed so theoretical. And I said, I just can't imagine if somebody coming up to me for work or help, you know, I need to communicate with my students now. I need a way to have them, you know, share their work with me, and going, but if you step back and take a look at a community of inquiry model, take these six research articles from 2003, give them a good read, write a reflection, and then we'll talk in 3 days.
Yeah.
And then I'll put you in Moodle.
Yeah. It's like we can shortcut that process.
Yeah, I don't know. And I'm not interested in dissing people, because I mean, we're all responding as best we can, and I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, I'm being unfair, but I felt like expedience has been the word, you know.
That was the word that I was just about to say. It's a pivot to expediency we've done. It's not necessarily something that we believe is the best long-term or sustainable solution. It's not. It's a plaster. It's a band-aid for a current solution, a current situation.
But as I was telling you, there was a conference call of managers at my institution on Friday, and it was mostly logistics stuff because of the campus being, you know, partially shut down and potentially fully shut down soon. And but then the deans were all given the chance to report, and all of them said that they had heard good things about the move online. And three separate deans said their instructors were telling them that their classes were better than ever and that they were seeing more engagement, more participation. And this was the part that surprised them. I know this is going to surprise no one who actually does this stuff, but they were so surprised to find out all these quiet students were suddenly speaking up online.
Yep.
And so these deans were all saying, our instructors are actually getting excited about the possibilities here. They're starting to see what can happen when you can bend time and space, which is what you can do online. And they're kind of excited about that conversation. So I hope we'll be ready to engage it, because there's a lot of crap out there. I'm really worried about some of the stuff that might fill in that void.
So that's the challenge, isn't it? That's the next pivot that we have to make. Now that we have this group of people engaged, and they see some of the value, they see the immediate expediency for a difficult situation, but they also see some of the unintended or unexpected consequences of that. Because, mm-hmm. you know, we all know technology changes how you teach and how students behave. It's not at all neutral, but how do we then reorient? So we've introduced them to online teaching, but not necessarily to a model that we think is the right long-term sustainable model. So how do we get back on course? How do we get back to some of the values that were in the OpenETC or that underpin the construction of the OpenETC? And how do we take people back to that? So there's the, you know, how do we bring people in as collaborators, but also there, you know, in the model that we have, there are kind of institutional champions who I think we anticipate taking on more of that collaboration activity. Mm-hmm. But beyond them, there are a whole bunch of institutional users who will generate any number of fantastic ideas, but, you know, probably not going to be the people who do the work to package those up and share them. You know, may not say an awful lot about what they're doing, but their institutional champion might circle around them and kind of collect and package a bunch of that. So how do we bring them back and show them some of the other things that are possible, and get them thinking about open pedagogy again? Because the set of tools that we have fallen back on, a closed LMS, a closed video conferencing system, mm-hmm. and a remote proctor, none of that speaks to open.
No. I would like to indulge in some perhaps wild and irresponsible optimism, actually, though.
No, that is very unlike you.
in the immediate after fact of, you know, when it became clear that the closures were coming, or the first were starting to get announced, and there was this, you know, it was true, like, you know, a bunch of people just went out and got Zoom licenses. But there was also this real wave of discourse coming from a lot of different voices saying, student care, student care. And as the smoke started to clear here at our institution, we started to realize that the things we were most afraid of from a technical point of view that make the system fall over, like everyone doing 3-hour live video conferences and making their students have their cameras on and recording everything, or timed scheduled exams with, you know, automatic grading at fixed times. Those were the things we were afraid were going to bring the system down. And then we were realizing, oh, that's exactly what is the worst thing to do from a student care perspective too. So we've been just, our mantra, which we say in almost every response, is what's good for the learning platform and the network is what's good for our students. And I was really pleased to see how the community got that message together so clearly and firmly really early on. And there were tons of people writing really good posts or just repeating the same things over and over again on Twitter. And I think that helped our group ground. I think it gave us a center. And I'm really hoping that some of those same voices will start to articulate what we're talking about in terms of using this moment to not just sink into a lockdown, very unimaginative online tool set, but to say, no, this is the time to take meaningful learning technology, you know, to another level.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're up to it. Like there's people out there that are smart enough to provide some really helpful stuff.
Well, and some of the conversations we've had in my institution have been around, you know, alternative assignments, alternatives to invigilated face-to-face exams, and saying to people, you've probably done this already. You've probably had to deal with this already. Remember that time you had to make a student accommodation for a student with an accessibility need? Well, you've probably done what it is you need to do for everybody now. And if you go back to UDL principles, you know, this is foundational stuff in a lot of that. And we have had to do these things, but we've done them as exceptions. And so, you know, when I'm asked, well, what about accessibility at this point in time? Let's not forget students with accessibility needs. My message has been over and over and over again, if you do now what you've done for students with accessibility needs, if you do that for every student, you will probably, you know, support every student in the way you want to see them supported.
Yeah. When I've been raising concerns about exams, I keep saying accessible assessments. That's what we need to be focused on, accessible assessments.
And what's
good about that too is, you know, rightfully so, people aren't going to come back at that directly. No, we demand we have the right to be inaccessible. I mean, they're thinking it. They want to do it, but they don't quite know how to say it.
The other thing is that treating students equally does not mean doing the same thing for every student.
Yeah.
So you might already have a digital remote proctored exam that you can offer to every student. And if that's what you've got, don't change that right now, because you don't need more complexity, right? But if you have a student who isn't able to do that because they rely on community internet and the only place that they can get an internet connection is Starbucks, right? Or they are at home and all of their family are also in the same home with them and they don't have a private space that they can do a proctored exam. Or, you know, they may have some more complex accessibility need. Well, then do something different for them. Do an oral exam or give them a timed assignment or, you know, heaven forbid if you have assessed all of their learning outcomes, exempt them from the exam and give them a mark. You know, all of these options are open to you. And some of the challenge I have at times is that message about equality is not doing the same for every student. Not every student starts from the same place. It's not a level playing field.
I wanted to say one more little bit, though, like on the lines you were talking about.
Yeah, go.
You know, the more, you know, in happier times, we used to talk about kind of like the future of higher education and, you know, with massification and the MOOCs and all that, like how does higher education assert itself? So I actually have talked to a few professors, not at my institution, but at other ones, and they can see how this stuff can be systematized. You know what I mean? Like, so if instructors are going to insist on straight content, push button assessments, automated everything, and lots of tracking, there are centralized, like the Pearson platform suddenly looks really good, and we don't need a professor for that. This is an existential threat to these people, and I hope they'll come to understand that. They have an opportunity to construct a human-focused, highly engaging, human form of digital learning. And they could be at the forefront of it, or they can fall back on the easiest, most expedient path and stay there, in which case I don't see a future for them.
I think any institution that's having to manage its pennies carefully right now, which will be a lot of them after after this settles, if you can, I mean, what's the most expensive cost in any institution? Mm-hmm. It's the wages bill, right?
I answered a support email this morning from an instructor who is using completely prepackaged content from a textbook, including all exercises and assessments, and wanted me to connect with their proctoring tool. And I'm going, well, we can do, well, no, we can't do that. That's what I told her. But I just don't know, like, if that person realizes they're not the essential part of this.
Yeah.
Right now, their function is to bring that content into the university and get it established within the curriculum. That's the role they're playing. And once it's in there, I don't know what they're needed for exactly.
Yeah. What is the role of the teacher?
If you outsource everything, what is the role?
Well, that's the core of the unbundling arguments, right?
Mm-hmm. So I think they should have every motivation to be looking for ways to be creative, engaging, and human, and to be really important to their students, and to have their students feel like they can really depend and count on them, if only for their own survival.
Well, and when we think about the response that's going to be needed to what we're all living through. I mean, if we think, I might get wildly optimistic for a moment here, or I don't know that it's optimism actually, but the role of education is never going to be more important than it will after this, because we're going to have a lot of unemployment. We're going to have a lot of industries struggling. We're going to have a need to retrain people. We're also going to have I think we're also going to have the challenge of recognizing learning, informal learning, much more. You know, we talk a lot in very theoretical terms about, you know, ideas around lifelong learning and non-traditional learners and credentialing experience and knowledge that you bring to an institution, as well as the formal study that you might do with us. And then how do we do that credentialing at a kind of smaller, more aggregated level? How do we, you know, get into micro credits and micro credentials and these kind of much more learner driven pathways through learning? All of that is only going to be more important, not less, because the need to reskill, the need to learn new skills, and the need to meet new challenges is only going to be more important, not less. Now, will we have the money to do that? Are most economies that have a health service going to invest in their health service first and their education sector second? Yes, of course. We're going to be doing it in constraint. I mean, it'll be fine in the US because they don't give a fuck about the health service.
No, I agree. A bunch of people have been saying, well, what's our learning environment? I actually got a question like, we're going to have this in our learning environment in the fall. And I'm like, the learning environment in the fall or in a year from now might be like us gathered around a flaming barrel by the railroad tracks. Some of these discussions seem so bizarre to me because with the amount of social disruption we can expect and...
But that, I think, is part of how we reframe the Open ETC. That it is, you know, to make it not look risky. that actually, and that we've been building on this already, you know, it's that core idea of collaboration and sharing and pooling our knowledge. And then what the OpenETC, official bit of the OpenETC, if you like, the core five of us does, is we take on that piece of work to take those good ideas and package them and turn them into the clonable templates. So you know, people collaborate, help provide support as a community of practice, and help provide ideas as a community of practice and examples as a community. And when we see, you know, when we see something that's going to be useful to other people as well, then the value we add is to package that and turn it into a turnkey solution through the Clone Zone. And to come back to your point on disruption, and we've talked about this in the past, you know, the extent to which that message is hammered into us that education is broken, it needs disruption, and, you know, that disruption has to come from outside. There's two kind of angles I want to go off on that one. The first is, you know, it's fundamentally wrong. We do know what we're doing. We just live in a system of mixed economy again. But, you know, we do know how to teach. We do know about technology. And I think something like the OpenETC shows that we can work out what it is we need, and we can deliver it for ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't need to.
We can do it cheaply too.
We can do it at a price that everybody can afford. Absolutely. And this disruption, just this fundamental idea that we don't know what we're doing and we don't know how to serve ourselves, when actually you look at all those big disruptive platforms that have appeared in the last few years. Where did Udacity come from? Where did edX come from? Where did Coursera come from? Where did FutureLearn come from? They came out of universities.
Oh, I thought it came out of the maw of hell, but anyway.
I'm not saying they're good.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. Know. I know. I'm not a good person to do chats with. You're making these perfectly legitimate little points, and I just kind of throw up all over them. That's our dynamic here. This is why I want to do a podcast with you. You provide the quality content, and I just don't do anything at all, actually. Yeah.
Okay. But I can live with that. I like talking.
This is exactly what I was envisioning.
I do like that framing. You know, I say something and you just puke all over it. Can we get some kind of iconography to go with the podcast?
I'll get a graphic designer to do that. You with this thoughtful look on your face, holding forth, and me just with like a bottle of tequila vomiting in the corner.
All of that innovation, I'm going to call it innovation, right? We hate them, but they were a form of innovation that came out of universities. Yes, it mostly came out of elite universities, you know, Stanford, MIT, Harvard, but also out of the Open University of the UK. And I do think FutureLearn is slightly different in that it was coming from an open access to education mandate, though arguably edX did originally as well, given the MIT open content link. But where was I even going with this? My brain has just frozen on me. What did you? Oh, Moodle. Yeah, the Moodle. I don't know. It's kind of frozen in time. When I look at what other, I don't love the LMS. I do believe it's a necessity. I believe it's a necessary evil. I think it's a piece of commodity infrastructure. And I think in large institutions, it does provide a function from a usability point of view. Even if you're using lots of other things, just to have an easy starting place.
Yeah. And you don't have to explain it to anybody. Like, nobody has come to us with questions. Like, everyone's had, how do I fix this thing? Or I can't find the edit link.
Yeah.
Which they're apparently putting back in the next version. But
Moodle as a
but nobody ever goes, I don't understand the concept here. Like, yeah. It is painfully literally close to how most traditional educators do things.
And there are times when closed spaces and walled gardens are important. If you teach counseling, you know, that's a whole subject area that's very, very difficult to teach in the open. Mm-hmm. If you teach medicine, that's a whole subject. Lots of medical resources are open resources for all sorts of good reasons, but actually the conversations that you might have as a group of, as a community, many of those have to be completely private because you're talking about patient case information in lots of, in lots of areas. So, you know, there are challenges to open pedagogy here with subjects that are difficult, you know, where there are other that have ethical implications of them, of their own.